gave them to Hani at that.
Hello, Odia. Can you hear us?
Anyone can you hear?
Yeah. Well, we don't hear Volodya.
Okay.
Speak again.
Then we are good. All right. Are we still getting echo?
Yes.
Very good. Excellent. So thank everybody for coming to this particle physics seminar. Today's talk will be Gabriel Damon. He is a postdoc in the Omega Group, and he is a candidate for the research staff. So please treat him with the respect he deserves. Unlike previous. Gabriel got his bachelor's from Bologna in, I think, 2012.
Yeah.
And then graduated with his PhD joint between Bologna and Bern. After another year working for Bologna, he came to his senses and joined us as a postdoc. And we've been very happy to have him here. He has a lot of expertise in silicon detectors and has been working on Atlas this entire time. So please, without further ado, he's going to help give us a story in four dimensions. And again, please, let's thank Gabriel and welcome him.
Thank you, Michael.
So, as the title implies, in this seminar will be about storytelling, which we are all passionate about. So storytelling, as we know, is the art of following the journey of our protagonist and telling the minutious details about the journey. And let me introduce for a second our protagonist. This is our protagonist. Maybe any part of it you may like, and any part of it you may be familiar with. And our protagonist is particularly interesting because by following its journey with a lot of precision, we and by understanding the properties of our protagonist, we will be able to understand the whole universe. This is fascinating because in practice, what it means is that what we can do in our daily life, that if we follow this journey close enough, we will be able to set an interesting story. However, in order to do this, we need to be extremely precise in how we narrate this story, in how we follow this path. So how do we do it? Let's contextualize our discussion. So the context is modern particle physics. It's kind of the lore of our discussion. The current status of particle physics is particle physics after the discovery of Higgs boson about 10 years ago, that kind of confirmed our expectations on fundamental interactions and was the coronation of more than half a century of research by the international community. However, this discovery opened the doors to many, many other questions. There are a plethora of unexplained phenomena in the universe that we are not able to explain with the current theory. So there are mainly two ways we can study these phenomena. This tends to be a rare event, so we can either observe them in nature, trying to minimize the rest of the nature we already know, so trying to minimize the background and building huge detectors to try to gather these some of these low statistics, or we can produce these phenomena in controlled environment, so in our laboratory space. Specifically for particle physics, and when we want to build to observe massive particles for the physics via massive particles, these require machines such as particle accelerators. These are amazing machines that, however, produce incredibly busy environment that in which the background that we produce can be orders of magnitude bigger than the event that is under study. One of the examples is the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, which produces about 1 billion particle interactions per second. Yeah, So how do we fix this? How do we observe this rare phenomenon? Well, we say that in these accelerators, we have billions of interactions per second, but they do not happen exactly at the same time. Actually, these interactions will be scattered in a small space and will happen at very small distances in time, the order of a few tens of hundreds of milliseconds apart from each other. So if we know exactly when and where these interactions happen, we might be able to disentangle the underlying physics and understand a bit better this phenomenon. So it has been known for quite a while, and I will stress today that silicon detectors are candidate ideal to achieve both a great knowledge in time resolution, and a great knowledge of where, so the space resolution of our event. So this is the kind of information we want to create, four-dimensional information to track the path of our particle. This is composed of time resolution, so the ability to reconstruct with precision the time of arrival in our detector of a particle, and a space resolution, the ability to reconstruct with precision the position of arrival of our particle. For a second, let's focus on the time of arrival, so on the time part of our four-dimensional information. We say that we need a certain amount of precision in time, but how much? Let's have a look at the expected, well, at the required time resolution for a few experiments either that have either been built recently, such as the two, or that will be built in the upcoming medium and long term future. Now, this is mostly for single point resolution on silicon detectors, and it's the best time resolution each of these experiments can achieve. So, different plug detectors may want to achieve different space resolution. But you see that on the y axis, we have the expected time resolution in picoseconds. That we go from about 100 picoseconds requirement for VEL2 down to about 35 picoseconds for the highly noted TLA3, well, some experiments are the highly noted TLA3, such as others of CMS, and we go down this order to the 20 picoseconds for the EIC of the neutron collider, down to even less 10 to 15 for the electronic FCC, and even down to 5 to 1 picoseconds times the resolution for the atomic FCC. So we might want to ask two questions. First of all, how do we achieve and what time resolution can we achieve with our current technology projected in the future? And how does this compare to our need? So let's break down time resolution. Now the contributions to the uncertainty on the time of arrival can arise mainly from three different sources. The sensor itself, in this case can be, for example, a silicon sensor, for example, due to the interaction of the particle that we are studying with our sensor, or for the way the signal is formed inside of our sensor, or due to the way electronics work, so during the passage in which we take the signal from the sensor and we drive it to our taking electronics, mostly for to electrical noise, for example. And finally, due to the discretization and readout steps of our readout systems. We can mathematically break this down in four main components that fall in the previous categories. The first one being, for silicon sensors, the Landau noise. The Landau noise is a signal distortion, so a distortion in the signal that we are creating when minimum ionizing particles interact with silicon crystals. So at each and every step of their way inside the silicon, they will release a random amount of energy. The second contribution is given by the so-called time warp. There is a perceived difference in time of arrival, depending due to the discretization triggering process, depending on the amplitude of the signal that we are studying. So a signal with an higher amplitude will be perceived as coming earlier simply because it will reach our amplitude threshold sooner than a lower signal. This can be, to some extent, sort of mitigated by using a method such as the contra fraction discrimination, in which we are moving the threshold up and down based on the total amplitude of the signal. And therefore, this effect can be strongly minimized if we take enough care of it. Finally, a big contribution comes from the jitter. Jitter is electrical noise that, due to the jitteriness of our signal, that creates an uncertainty in the time of arrival. Now, if we want to formulate, street dirt is basically a function of the signal to noise ratio of our signal. Therefore, a signal with an higher amplitude will decrease and will mitigate the effect of the jitter. So how can we achieve this? One way is to use dedicated sensors, such as, for example, this specific design of sensor or silicon sensor called the low gain avalanche diode, that we call the LGAM from now on. Now, with this type of detector can achieve a boost in signal thanks to a dedicated implant in the silicon called a gain layer. A gain layer boosts the signal thanks to a very high and uniform electric field in this region. You can see the electric field here on the left that is high enough to start an avalanche effect and multiply the signal created by a factor. By a factor of 10 to 100, depending on the topic itself. So this can minimize, again, not completely remove, but minimize the effect of the jitter, and together with the removal of the effect of the fine wall, leaves us mostly with effect from the electronics and effect from the lambda noise. Knowing this, we can try to measure time restriction. We did this in the past by looking at the various different LGAP sensors produced here at Brookhaven, so designed and fabricated here at Brookhaven. Each of these lines represents the time resolution on the y-axis in picosecond for four different LGAP sensors. Each of them has different dopings and doping and implant energies as a function of the gain of the sensor, which is a function of the breakdown of the bias voltage, basically. You can see that with this technology, we are able to consistently reach time resolutions that are under 30 picoseconds, and by fine-tuning the doping, even as low as 26 picoseconds. So how does this compare to the requirement I showed you earlier? So let's see again this plot. This whole area can be covered in terms of timing, maybe not in terms of other parameters, by using sensors with high gain, such as the low gain of avalanche diode. However, time resolution tends to level off at around 25 to 30 picoseconds due to the Landau fluctuations that cannot be easily mitigated and are intrinsic in particle-to-sensor interactions. Recent studies by our friends at KK Japan showed us that with thinner sensors and better extraction ways, we can bring this number down. So if we're smart enough, we can manage to reconstruct timings with a precision of down to 15 to 20 picoseconds. But this leaves a whole area that is completely uncovered and unexplored. And you will see that many of the accelerators in the future need to reach this critical time resolution. So this is my first call to action of the day, but we need several. And the first one is that it's never too late to start looking into this because we are completely blind, unless on breakthrough, to these physics that will be created in the future. As a mental experiment, whenever you look at a date connected to a future accelerator, a future experiment, I invite you to remember how long it takes to go from the R&D phase through the study, production, commissioning, installation phase of any of these accelerators. And on average, it may take around 2 decades. So whenever you see these numbers, try mentally to remove 20 years. This is the date which is very important for us to have a very good plan on how to tackle these kinds of challenges. And you see that for some of the future accelerators, it considerably sooner than we might expect. Now, this gives us an understanding of what our current reach in time resolution is. We want now to focus on the second part of our four-dimensional information, the space resolution. Now, space resolution is something we can already achieve. With many of our experiments. You may be familiar with all the trackers that we have in Atlas and CMS and other experiments. So we may think, okay, let's say that we have a multi-layer tracker. We want to achieve a better space resolution. We can just higher granularity, create smaller pixels, smaller strips, make everything smaller, and this automatically will give us a better space resolution. To some extent, this is true. But first of all, this is technologically very challenging, and we're approaching a point at which many of our technologies for silicon sensors cannot be consistently scaled down over sizes. For example, the L-GAT paradigm I showed you before cannot really scale down to pitches that are lower than 1 millimeter without losing quite a part of their beam. Plus, by increasing a factor n, the granularity, we are effectively increasing by a factor n squared, the amount of channels to be read out. Therefore, the read-out length is already a critical problem. The power consumption of our detector. So this might be even more challenging than not achieving the space resolution. So what is the alternative in this case? I want to be philosophical for a second. Let's say that there is a print with any pose. Let's say, obviously. Now, we are experimental physicists, so we want to ask, where did it go? Now, since we are pragmatic people, we put a bunch of microphones in the forest, we put all the lines, all the cables, and we start to record the noise, and we try to understand the location by looking at which microphones have heard something. So all of them have heard anything, they say, yes, I've heard it. This is a binary information, is it yes or no? And this information will be able to constrain the local area, well, the area of the tree folding around this area, around our detectors, our microphones. So we can improve our space resolution by putting a bunch of microphones around this area, which is tricky to do. We would have to throw out a lot of lines in the forest, and the squirrels won't be as heavy. Or we can check how loud is the signal that we are getting from each of these microphones. So if each microphone is a response that is proportional to the vicinity, to the falling tree, we can better interpolate the position of the tree using, for example, a center of gravity meter. Can we do the same for particles? About a decade ago at this point, it was this proposal of the AC coupled slow gain adoption. This is, as the name implies, a modification of the L-GAT paradigm we saw earlier. It's very similar in terms of construction, it does have the same gain here, but with a few modifications. So here at Brookhaven, we produced some samples divided either in pixels, strips, or other geometries. And the main caveat with this kind of detector is the ability to exploit signal sharing that can give us a great space resolution. So how does signal sharing work? Let's say that this is our 3x3 pixel AC antenna, basically what we are seeing here. Let's say a particle interacts in there. What will happen is that it's going to release charge inside of our sensor, inside of our silicon, and this charge is going to spread within our silicon. This, in turn, will induce signals on all of our paths, and we induce these signals as proportional to the amount of charge that reaches that specific point of the vector, thus giving us multiple responses to a single particle proportional to the vicinity of from the path to the particle. And this allows us to have a very high spatial resolution with possibly lower granularity. Now, we obviously wanted to test this in the laboratory. So we took one of our ACL gaps divided in strips. This is again produced by Bocaren. And we have white bonded this ACL gap to a setup in which we could shine a laser at very specific positions on the deck. Now, this is a scheme of these strips. I announced the region of interest at the middle. And we read out four different strips labeled A, B, C, and D. Then we focused this very narrow laser either at the center of the detector between strips B and C, or in the gap between the stage A and B, just to the left, or in the gap between the stage C and B, just to the right. And we read out all four channels in all three configurations. Now, when reading out the four channels, when the four strips, when the laser was focused at the center of the vector, what we observed is that the two strips that are closer to the laser focusing point, B and C, showed the highest signal with the highest amplitude, while strips a bit farther, A and B, showed the signal that it was considerably lower, but still non-negligible. Also, as you may see, the strips at the same distance from the interaction point show signals of the same amplitude, so they are divided in pairs. If we move to the left point and the right point, we can see that the two strips that are closer to, for example, the right interaction point, C and D, show the same signal, and the one that is a bit further, B, show a signal that is of lower amplitude, and the one that is farthest, A, show a signal that is even lower. And this is obviously symmetrical on the other side of the detector. So this proves the concept, but does not tell us how to actually reconstruct the position. This is just a bunch of waveforms with different amplitudes. So there must be something between the shared signal that we can acquire and the reconstruction of a position in the detector that allows us to do this translation. Now, this is a calibration procedure that we set up using the same laser setup I showed you before. So in this specific case, we were reading out two strips. You can see the two strips, this is magnified on the center of the device, on the left and right in yellow. And we focus the laser on many different points in between the two strips. For each of these laser focusing points, we took the waveforms coming from our strips, and we calculated the fraction of our signal that each of the two strips, so the left strip and the right strip, would see normalized to the total amount of amplitude that is seen by the detector. This is plotted, in this case, as a function of the position of the laser between the left strip and the right strip. And you can clearly see that, obviously, the closer we are to the left strip, the leftmost strip, the higher the percentage of signal we go to the leftmost strip compared to the right one, and this will be mirrored on the other direction. This gives us the possibility to match a position of the particle, X laser, to a response of the detector, and find the calibration parameters for each of these current strips. We can fit these calibration parameters to any reconstruction method. In this specific case, we use simple chi-square minimization, but other methods can be used. Some groups are using machine learning or advanced methods to translate a set of amplitudes into a position on the detector. But does it actually work for particles we may be interested in, not just for lasers in the laboratory? Well, we partnered with our friends at Fermilab and with their amazing silicon telescope, which is machine, to test the phase resolution of ENL made ACL gas to a beam of 120 megahertz of all protons. And the focus of the study was to test the signal shape in the space resolution of these devices as a function of the geometry of the electrodes and other construction parameters of the device, such as the resistivity for the N-plus layer and others. Now, there are three main sets of measurements I want to show you today. The first one is a measurement of devices that were not created by BNM, but were created by Hamamatsu Photonics, which is the practically industry leader in silicon for high energy physics. They created these devices divided into pixels with a pitch of 500 micrometers. They managed to achieve with this beam of protons a space a time resolution of about 30 picoseconds, which is compatible to the one that we observed for LGAP, since this is basically the same technology, but with a space resolution of about 22 to 24 micrometers. The test went on with this device produced by BNL. This is a testing device, as you can see from the weird shapes, and you may see that it's divided in three different regions. a so-called wide region, when there is a wide space in the intersection, a medium region, in which there is a gap that is a bit lower than the wide region, and finally a narrow region, in which the gap is minimal. In practice, this translates to a pitch of either 200, 150, or 100 micrometers. While they managed to achieve a time resolution that is very similar to the one achieved for both a gap or MLAMP sensors, the space resolution went down this pitch to about 10 micrometers. The test went on with a final device produced at VNL with slightly different resistivity, but with the same pitch as the number one, achieving the same time resolution, 30 picoseconds, but a space resolution of less than 6 micrometers. And I say less than 6 micrometers because this is constrained by the testing setup and not by the testing. So we actually don't know what the space resolution is very fast. Okay, but is this a good method to do space resolution anyway? I mean, how do we compare these numbers with the numbers we can get from ITK or from any other tracker? But let's do a Gedanken experiment. Let's take this ACL gap. This has, we say, a pitch of 100 micrometers. If we had used a binary data, so that what is commonly used for our experiment, the space resolution would have been limited by pitch of the sensor divided by the square root of 12. This is common knowledge. And the divided square root of 12 is about 30. We achieve 6. This is a factor 5 increase in space resolution by using exactly the same number of channels, exactly the same geometries, and exactly what the same sensor. This is a very powerful tool for future experiments. So I hope I managed to convince you today that ACL gaps are excellent candidates for future 4D detectors because they can reach a resolution of less than 30 picoseconds. Thank you for that again, and we have seen that this can be improved by using thinner sensors. There are some preliminary results that are very encouraging. Then space resolutions in the order of 2 micrometers, thanks to their signal sharing capabilities, and we are still trying to identify what the optimal sweet spot between pitch distance, doping, resistivity, etc., to maximize our space resolution. Now you may see, you may say, not a detector, this is a sensor. And I would agree with it. So we started having a look at how to build a real 4D detector, a full 4D detector we can actually use in our experiment. But there are several differences between what we are doing right now and what is done with a real detector. The first of all, the first difference is the readout system. So in the laboratory setup that we have used, something like this, we have custom discrete electronics to read out our sensor. This is more big as our sensor is 2 by 2 millimeters, maybe. And you see the amount of electronics we need to use to read out just this batch of streams. We have to connect this with an oscilloscope. It's very bulky, definitely not scalable. When we are in a real for the detector, these are large scale systems with millions of channels that we need to read out with the minimal amount of electronics as possible. So we need a readout chip of sort. First of all, because as we say, it's a scalable solution to acquire signal from hundreds, thousands, millions, if possible, of sensors, but not only to acquire this information, but to digitalize it and digitalize important parameters of the signal to be stored. For example, the time of arrival, the time per threshold, the amplitude of the signal, whatever we made in our reconstruction and analysis effort. And finally, this must pack everything neatly in a digital way for the digital information that we can bring out from our spectrum. Now, we do not have yet a chip dedicated, a readout chip dedicated to the ACL gap. But what we do have are chips dedicated to standard reference for the eigenvalue timing detector for the Angular grade of eigenvalue. Now, this is a very simplified scheme of how one of these chips work. And this is specifically the Atlas LGAD timing readout chip, or Alcura. So, what we did, we coupled path, in this case, strips of an ACL gap directly to this Alcura chip, the signal would pass through a preamplifier stage and a listening stage, and each chip would give us two signals for each state that we are reading out, an analog signal, which is basically an amplified and shaped version of the signal that we get from the ACL GAN, and a digital signal. There is a digital information that passes information of the time of arrival of the original signal and the time of arrival, so the amount of charge basically went down. We do have several questions. The first of all is, can we even read this with this sensor using this chip? This chip is not even designed for this kind of signals or for this kind of detector, so we were unsure whether or not this was even possible. Now, what we did is we took this is the field gap, it's exactly identical to the one I showed you before. And we wire bonded the four of the strips, the four central strips, to the four input channels of the outer chip. Here's the outer chip, these are the four channels. There's a direct wire bond. We took these things, we took this entire setup and we put it inside this object. It's a transient current technique station, a TCT station. We'll not go into details on how this works, but in practice, this is a device that allows us to focus a laser at a very precise position on our sensor with a precision recognition of 1 micrometer, and then move the laser with respect to the sensor and to scan the response of the sensor as a function of x and y. This would effectively create a photograph to some extent in the charge space of our sensor. And this is what we obtained. You can see the detector, but this is not a real photograph. But what we did, we read out this specific script and we read it out as from the output, from the analog output of the outer chip. So the laser basically is scanned by injecting charge each of these lines, and from the amount of charge we get from reading out this strip, we could recreate it. So this tells us two things, probably. First of all, that we are reading out charge through the outgrip from the ACL gap. We are actually seeing signal generated by the ACL gap to outgrip. And the second is an information that we are getting from this yellow halo around our strip. Now, what is halo? This halo is telling us that if we point the laser, for example, here, then we are seeing signal in a strip located here. This is an example of signal sharing read out via the outer chip. So the signal is generated here, and then the charge moves in the silicon and induces a signal also in our stream. So this answers our first question, and partially also a second question, whether or not we can access ACL GAN signal sharing capabilities with this chip. Now, we want to make sure that we can actually do this, and we want to characterize the impact of the chip on the signal sharing. So we repeated a similar experience to the one I showed before. We took our lovely sensor, we focused the laser in either the central point or in the left pitch or in the right pitch, exactly as before, and read out the full sensor strip. Again, this is completely identical to the sensor you saw earlier. And you see that while the shape of the waveform is different, due to the fact that it's passing through a preamplifier stage, the signal sharing remains in place. So in this case, strips B and C, the closest one, see the same signal, as well as strip A and B, that's the same for the lateral ones, we might see that there is something slightly different. But again, this confirms our expectations. Let's compare what we observe by reading out the ACL gap to outgrip on the top three plots to what we observe by reading out the ACL gap to the distributed in the three. In all three cases, the position is exactly the same, the vector is exactly the same. What we observe is that the shared signal in the case of outgrip seems to be different in terms of ratio with respect to the total signal when compared to the case in which we are reading it out with a single electron. So in this case, the eigen signal is about twice tall at the length of the shared, and about three times higher when we use discrete electronics. So this is our first indication of the impact we are getting from reading out without, you know, these signals. And we can observe the effect of the signal sharing through these, I like to call signal sharing profiles, in which we put the same information as before. So the left plot is for the left point, the gray area, the central point for the central plot for the center point, and the right plot for the right point, and the gray band represents the position of the laser. And we observe the fraction of signal that each of the four strips observed as a function of the position of the laser for both the sensor connected to Altino in the blue line and the sensor connected to the discrete board in the orange line. We do see that there is a consistent decrease for the discrete version compared to the Altino version. And we expect that in first on first order, this is due to a different input impedance of Altino with respect to the discrete component. So this is an effect that we need to take into account when we calculate the desired signal sharing and therefore the desired space resolution when we want to optimize other vector for our sensor. Now, this covers the first 3 points. However, as I mentioned earlier, we are not using a Riddle chip just to acquire waves. What we want to do is to acquire and digitalize parameters of networks to be used in our final reconstruction. Can we do it? Can we exploit the digital signal from Altino using an ACR algorithm? So by using the setup as we observed before, we have used either betas from a strontium 90 source interacting with our ACL gap or the infrared laser we observed earlier, and we try to digitalize the analog signal. So the bottom blue line is the analog signal that gets created by the preamplifier stage party rocker. You can see that these are both in the same scale. You can see that the signal from the infrared laser is far stronger in terms of amplitude from the spectrum, the signal from the beta interaction. And we can observe that the digital signal is created in both cases as the same amplitude, because it's digital, but as a width that is considerably higher for the interaction with the infrared laser than for the interaction, that we compare to the interaction with the strontium 90 beta. This is due to the fact that in Altiroc, these information I was telling you about are encoded in a specific way so that the width of the digital signal is a representation of the time over threshold, so to some extent of the charge of the analog signal. So the bigger the signal, the wider the digitalized version. You can also observe that the analog amplitude is the amplitude of the analog signal is a good proxy for the time over threshold of the analog signal. So what we can do is to generate interactions with a wide range of amplitude. For example, interactions using a 790 source that, as we mentioned earlier, can give interactions of a wide variety of deposited energy due to the natural distortion. So you see the amplitude of the analog signal from the x-axis, and we can observe the width of the digital signal that is created from the analog signal on the y-axis. You can see that there is some sort of dependence, which is almost linear, although with some steps and some artifacts. But nonetheless, there is a correlation between two. So we can exploit the digitalization of the strips, the digitalization of the analog signal, but however, this does not allow to exploit the main characteristics of ACL gap, which is signal sharing. And Altino is not thought to be able to use signal sharing, and therefore we know that we needed a dedicated readout chip that supports it. So we took all these studies that were made in collaboration with our friends at the IGC Lab and the Omega Groups in France, which designed the Algero chip, and worked and are working with them in a new version of this chip, effectively an evolution of Algero, for the ESCO, and as the name implies, it's dedicated to the electron ion collider that we believe here at Brookhaven, the 2230s. The difference between Altero and the ICRO is that Altero targeted the normal DC L gap, while the ICRO targets the AC L gap. There are changes in capacitance, impedance, taking into account this difference in input capacitor from the sensor. We have more channels, 16 instead of 4, and the TDC, or the visualization of the time over threshold, has been substituted to a multi-channel ADC for the visualization of the amplitude in order to be able to acquire amplitude signals from all the channels at the same time and exploit signal sharing. Now, there are many interesting results, although very preliminary, about the usage of the IC rocker. I think they are outside the scope of today's presentation, but there is a pretty dedicated group working on this right now. And I want to end, yes, because it's already 42 minutes, on what is both a call to action and a positive. So today I introduced many issues of accelerators and detectors in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. The time and space resolution, for example, that is a problem that we need to face, but we have noticed that the ACL gap or other similar concepts, we can deliver excellent 4D performances. And we do have several ideas now to take this even further. Now, many of you may notice that radiation hardness is still a pretty big concern, especially for hadronic accelerators. However, there are many reasons that think that new materials, such as new types of semiconductors, new types of geometries, such as L-gap, in which the green layer is buried, or new types of dopings have shown potential to help with withstanding extreme fluences for the future. Many problems arise from the heavy material budget of leptonic colliders and muonic colliders in the future, as well as power consumption. But there is a pretty strong push toward the creation of monolithic sensors that can help with both by decreasing both the material budget and the power sensor side. Finally, as we said, using smarter ways to reconstruct the position, such as, for example, ACL gap, together with new methods, such as machine learning methods that are implemented directly in hardware, can make data acquisition and reconstruction far more efficient and profitable in the studies around this. Final note, everything I told you so far seems to be very well constrained in the space of a laboratory. So what we're trying to do right now is to create some sort of baseline for future four-dimensional studies by creating a smaller ACL-GAD-based telescope. In a better world, I would have shown you a picture today and not a mock-up, but that's another story. This is a telescope that is based on ACL gap technology and is expected to be very modular in nature, so to be upgraded and updated in the future. And all the boards and electronics is meant to be swappable in the future for future studies and development. We should have a first beam here at the Tampere Valley Graph very early, very soon, meaning 24 hours. Might happen next week. But this is a third, well, an additional step in the direction of that. A real 4D demonstrator and a real 4D detector. I don't think I need to go through the entire recap. I just want to stress the final point that we cannot just be complacent. We need to drive advancement in material science, in machine learning, in detector design to face what is coming next. Because regardless of which beautiful accelerator machine we will build in the future, whether it's leptonic, hadronic, muonic, or whatever else, if we do not step up our game, we will be blind to all the exciting new physics these machines will produce. This being said, I want to thank all of you for your attention and leave the clients want to talk about that with the operational studies. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Gabrielle.
So, are there any questions?
So, Gabrielle, you mentioned the different time resolution requirements for the different machines. Can you go back to that slide and explain a bit more what drives these requirements? Where do they come from? Why does it drop so much?
Yes, as I said, so I was very selective in choosing these numbers, the specific requirement. So I want to make sure that you understand that not all of these machines require this specific time resolution for all of their subsystems. This is very silicon centric. This is focused on single point time resolution. Obviously, there are other ways to have better time resolutions. And each of these machines are going to use this time resolution for the different purposes. So for Bell 2 and for, in general, for also electronic collider, this is mostly due to the need for particle identification, so time of flight, mostly. For the high luminosity LHC, as well as future atom collider, this will be for pileup mitigation. So for the high luminosity LHC, the plan is to add, at least for Atlas and CMS, some additional timing layers, that was my of the tracker, namely the eigenlight time detector for Atlas and the end cap. The timing layer and detector, ETD, if I remember correctly, for CMS, they will basically work in very similar ways, although the actual structure will be different. They will use LGAD sensors, so the technology I showed before. And the idea there is to basically timestamp each of the particles that will pass through the existing layers of the ITK, but this is for pileup mitigation. So we know that high luminosity LHC will have a pileup about 10 times as well, 8 to 10 times as bigger than the one that we have right now, so about 200, 250. And some studies suggest that for the future random collider, this number might go up to about 1,000 of pileup. And you see these are reflected in the requirement of the for the time for the timing for the pileup mitigation of 35 picoseconds for the high luminosity LHC and 5 to 1 picosecond for the FCC. In the specific case, it's 5 picoseconds for the well, for the parallel, basically, and 1 picosecond for the forward region. However, the reason, okay, I want to stress a point. The reason at this point I say that this area is covered, and then I say, well, this is too for timing, is that clearly there are several other challenges that need to be faced when designing this sensor that are not necessarily timing related. One of the examples is radiation atoms. So you know that even if you have the best silicon sensor timing wise, but the sensor cannot withstand radiation, it will still not be a reasonable candidate. Finally, I think that missing, yes, is muon colliders. For muon colliders, this this strict timing requirement answer the very strict requirement regarding beam induced background depression. So one big issue with muon machines is that well, the surrounding electronics and the surrounding material will create quite a huge background created by the beam itself that may mask effectively the physics. So a good understanding of the time of arrivals and the coincidences of this interaction will help with the specific problem.
Thank you.
Just a question for the radiation hardening. So all the spatial resolution you showed here is before irradiation, right? So maybe after this operation, you get irradiated all those particles, neutrons. What if it's performance degrade a lot,
right?
So you don't get such a gain, the gain decrease, and you don't get signal from the nearby strips. So your resolution will be very, very bad, right?
That is completely correct. Time resolution is strongly affected by radiation and by acquired dose. In fact, these are quite often shown as the target number, for an efficient physics data taking, That doesn't mean that this is the target number for the technology itself. Usually, what it happens is that the effect of radiation damage is mitigated by either increasing the gain, so by increasing the bias voltage of the sensor, or by adding additional layers, or by creating sensors that natively have a better time resolution than the requirement for the physics. So yeah, this is the physics goal, not the technological goal to some extent. And yes, this strongly affects, as you mentioned, the time resolution. However, there are various ideas on how to mitigate this. Mainly, they are based on two principles. Either we find materials that are innately more radiation hard, or we find materials that can, to some extent, recover from the radiation damage because of the way the acceptors and donors inside the silicon are actually positioned inside the silicon. So by doping them in different ways. There are some recovery methods that have been tested. Not all of them were successful, but yeah, it's pretty challenging. I agree with you. Yes.
All right. We just there's another one. Yeah, no, I just want to make sure that no one is on.
Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
So basically, I have a couple of questions. So first is, how will you integrate the full detector to a full detector? So there are a lot of components you need to consider. For example, you mentioned the material budget, how you control that things is particles travel from through the sensor you can deflect. And you need a global reconstruction rather than just being by the pitch of the each side of the sensor. Another would be related to the energy deposits. For example, the CMSHG call claimed to have 5D information, energy and 4D XYZT. So what is the advantage of LGAS compared to all kinds of detectors?
Okay, I will answer first the first question. I think that for that specific question, a very interesting case study will be the electron ion collider, the Ergo Cannon, because they have, in my knowledge, the first large scale experiment using the ACL gap technology. One of the main, So when designing this EACROP, it will be effectively the readout sheet for this ACL gap. The idea was to try and mimic as much as possible the structure of the old experience and then start from there. Now, obviously, the background rejection specifically will be critical, but the actual amount of silicon that will be used for the sensors itself will not be considerably higher, well, won't be higher at all compared to a normal 2D silicon sensor to some extent. In practice, I foresee that the main big improvement we can do in terms of simplifying this design, making it more material budget friendly, is going the monolithic way. However, this is extremely challenging right now, and to my knowledge, no one has managed yet, with Alessandro for this, to create a monolithic ACL gap. Exactly, Alessandro says yes. So yes, I'd say that the electron ion collider will be our benchmark, and we lay the technological foundation for what we can do with this type of detectors going on. And I remember your second question. HGCAL. Okay. I don't know specifics of HGCAL. However, I would stress on the point that the calorimeter is a very different crystal compared to a silicon sensor. So a calorimeter has to be more focused on the average charge, well, the total charge that we're going to create, so they can be very precise because there's a lot of charge involved. In the specific case of semiconductor detectors, especially this screen, we are trying to get the most from a limited amount of interactions, well, of deposited charge to some extent, because quite often these objects tend to be the first layer that are encountered by the particles. So we want to minimize our interaction and our disruption of their path to some extent, so that they can be absorbed, for example, or read out by a calorimeter. So why there are examples of 5D calorimeters, and quite often calorimeters can claim time resolutions that are far better than these ones. It also needs to be, but there are already calorimeters that are able to achieve time resolutions in the order of tens of picoseconds. It must be kept in mind that the calorimeter tends to be very destructive when it comes to particle interaction, and that is not the case with the with silicon sensors, especially the thin. So they are complementary calorimeters. I think with coupling this information to information coming from a calorimeter, we can both then apply the well, this dual stage reconstruction. I hope this answers your questions.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And by the way, the issue you got is also made of physical circuits.
Yeah. No. Sure. I mean, you can have calorimeter made of silicon. It's just the way they are built and the, well, as you wish, the design principle is completely different, I think. They are not meant to see the same things, nor they are meant to interact in the same way with the particles, despite the material may be the same and some of the underlying physics may be the same. I think they have complementary effects.
Thank you.
All right. Are there other questions?
If not, I have one.
Yes.
So you didn't really touch on power much.
Yes.
Comparing, for example, the use of HDL gas to standard PIC sensors.
So, I didn't ask too much power. In general, many of these, what I call the six critical points, to some extent, mostly because it's not particularly easy to justify a number when it comes to, in terms of a reduction in power consumption by a factor of S. We are relatively confident that the decrease in numbers of channels will read out. So the decrease in granularity that comes naturally with adopting this kind of proportional readout technologies can benefit the power consumption. And we know for a fact that, or at least based on our previous tests, we do not see any additional power consumption coming from using ACL cap compared to more traditional fixtures. So they do not draw more current, they do not require higher voltages and stuff like that. Now, one of the main benefits in terms of power consumption comes from the way we can use ACL gap information. So one of the things that is being explored for the Roman pot detector of the electronic library using EIC is to have an event-driven approach to data taking instead of a fully triggered approach. This would mean that given a interaction above a certain threshold in any of the strips of the ACL gap, we may want to read just a certain portion of our detector and not the main detector, thus decreasing considerably the requirement for additional channels, for additional power consumption. However, while the number of channels, the way number of channels, well, readout bandwidth scales can be more easily understood by this reduction in granularity, giving a number on the power consumption itself, I think at this stage, or at least I don't have a very good number or a very good sense of how much it can get better. I'm pretty confident based on what we've seen so far and what we expect that number will go down quite a lot, especially compared to a detector able to achieve the same, well, silicon detector able to achieve the same spatial resolution and the same time resolution
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's fair, though. I'll point out that the moving of intelligence closer and taking advantage of machine learning is going to raise the power and the surfaces potentially, at least locally.
Yes. I think there are also ways to implement intelligence on silicon in a way that is far more energetically efficient than machine learning as we're using it right now, which is historically not particularly effective.
Sure.
That is a very interesting area of research. I think it will become increasingly important in the future, but I don't have a good sense of an answer, like, whether or not these can match these, how much this new method can decrease the thing. I think we need to strike some sort of balance and reduce the power consumption as much as we can, where we can. But I think physics is our final goal.
So at the moment, the power consumption, the goal is 1 milliwatt per pixel, driven by the TDC. And we have 3 milliwatts. So, but for EAC, the goal is 1 milliwatt per pixel. Yeah. But currently, Azure Arc has 3 milliwatts per pixel. So this is possible. This is with the 130 nanometer node.
165 node.
Yeah, 130 nanometers node. If you go to 65, we're pretty reduced. And then if you go 32, even more. So this is something in the future will go down by technology. But the question is interesting, what can you do with we put intelligence on chip. So I think actually if you use the same chip that were proposed for SDK, so rather than on event by event basis, they do an analysis, but it becomes pattern. Like the what's the
power hungry monsters.
Well, I mean, yeah, but no, I think that
we're eight power like.
Yeah, but this I think it is in a sense I think it'd be the way forward to use technology stepping forward, not to analyze on an event basis when you have a very high multiplicity, for example.
I think. Okay.
So this is maybe in hardware colliders.
Okay.
So try to not to scale with multiplicity or the occupancy, but scale with maybe the intelligence you want to put in there.
Okay, that's interesting.
But yeah, it's not there yet.
Yeah. But okay. Many of the things that work presented in the science slide are out there. So that's what makes it fun. But again, we are thinking about the next half century. All right, so are there any other questions? If not, we'll be taking the speaker out to Spiro's tonight at 6. Otherwise, let's thank him again and prepare for the next 50 years.
She was like, and is Arby not like this?
Thank you.
Now we know what's happening.